Welcome to The Rundown. I'm your host, Justin Pugliese. This podcast is dedicated to you, the run community. Each episode, we bring you interviews with top athletes and community leaders. They'll share their stories, tips, and tricks to inspire and motivate you to keep running. Ultimately, we're all just here to have fun. From elite runners to weekend warriors, find out how people get started and why they keep going. So listen up, tell your run buddies, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on Apple Music, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Previously on The Rundown with Marge Jean-Louis.
Sometimes you don't see the result of what you're doing until you get there. And I feel like it's made me trust the process so much. Where, yes, I'm going to go for a speed run, and tomorrow morning I will not be faster. You know, like I will not be stronger the next day. But if I do this consistently, if I put in the right amount of work and effort, then amazing things can happen.
On this episode of The Rundown, we went on an adventure with ultra-distance runner and world explorer Ray Zahab. Looking at him now, you'd never guess he used to be a big smoker and drinker. But in his early 30s, he decided he had had enough and changed the course of his life. He's traveled through jungles, extreme cold and grueling heat, crossed countries, continents, and thousands of miles, including crossing the Sahara in 111 days, which opened his eyes to all of life's possibilities. This episode is brought to you by VeloFix. As runners, there's not much to worry about in terms of equipment maintenance or tune-ups. But for those cyclists and triathletes out there, and speaking from my own experience, finding a bike shop with efficient customer-facing mechanics can be a challenge. Well, now it's time to change gears with VeloFix. With easy online booking, VeloFix sends a maintenance van straight to your door and provides same-day service with a smile. Head to VeloFix.com and use promo code LARUNDOWN15 for 15% off your tune-up. And if you happen to be looking for a bike mechanic gig, VeloFix is looking to expand their fleet in Quebec. Check out VeloFix.com to apply. In this week's news, Buleli Mathanga raced the 10,000-meter barefoot and set a provincial record in the process. I guess that solves the shoe debate. Well, that's exactly why he decided to do it. A few weeks earlier, he ran a 5,000-meter personal best in 13:47:23 and faced criticism for doing so while wearing the Nike Vaporflies instead of race spikes. He didn't wear the race spikes because they hurt his legs. So instead of racing in discomfort for this race, Mathanga and his coach decided to wear no shoes at all, and the result was amazing. This wasn't the first time he's done it, as he's ran barefoot in cross-country, track, and road races before with great success. He hopes a different set of spikes will help solve his problem, but if not, don't be surprised to see this trend continue because running barefoot seems to be working for him just fine. Make sure to check the show notes for links to information about this story, as well as ongoing protests. There will also be a list of funds and foundations that need your support, so please consider donating to help support this movement. That's all for now. Gotta run. On my podcast, or on this podcast, we've had a lot of elite runners, community leaders. We haven't had many explorers, and our next guest, that's what he's known for. He's one of the best explorers in Canada. He's run across countries, across continents. He's an ultra runner, but hopefully we get to hear his story a little bit and to know like that maybe it wasn't always meant to be that way, but how things can change in a hurry. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the show Ray Zahab.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thanks. Thanks so much for taking the time. If I wanted to list all your accomplishments in that intro, it probably would have taken me an hour alone. So I'd rather hear it from your words, not mine, but it's a pretty impressive resume.
Well, it's funny, you know, the time flies and you do one thing after another and, you know, pretty soon the mileage adds up. But, you know, I try not to, or I haven't at least, to this point in my career, really looked back a lot. I mean, obviously in conversations like these I do, but I mean, in the intro you're saying, oh, so we have this explorer on, and I'm like, ooh, I can't wait to hear who they're having on. And then I realize that I'm going to be talking to you, right? It's one of those funny things where you have to sometimes... you scratch yourself a little bit because you just poke yourself because you cannot believe. I'm very fortunate that I get to do what I love to do. And life is about, you know, finding that one thing that we can be passionate about. And you got literally one trip on the planet, a finite amount of time on this planet. I didn't always think this way, but, you know, now these in the second half, I like to say, of my life, I do. And doing these expeditions to the tune now of, my gosh, close to 20,000 kilometers I've covered on foot on deserts and Arctic regions and everything else, that I occasionally in these conversations look back and say, wow, I'm just so stoked to have visited so many amazing places on this planet with my feet, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how far they can carry us, you know? And I mean, I've heard many conversations that you've had and, you know, you remain very humble about it all, you know, and kind of like that pinch me kind of attitude almost, like that, you know, you have accomplished so much, but yet it's like you can still look back and remember kind of where it all began, you know?
Yeah, I think that a path for me when I chose to change what it is that I guess you could say what I wasn't doing. So quick, you know, synopsis. Prior to 30, I was a pack-a-day smoker, sometimes two packs a day, pretty unhealthy guy. A lot of people, you know, in the sort of ultra-adventure world, you discover, and I've had many friends that have sort of gone through a similar transition, right? But at any rate, whatever you're going through yourself, whatever you're experiencing yourself is very much relative to you as an individual. So those difficult times that you go through in your life is very hard to necessarily explain or compare to someone else's experience. So when you're living it, you know, it and it's something difficult, it feels super difficult, right? Because it's something that you internalize and you know, and it's your experience and it's your life. But when I decided that I was no longer satisfied living a life that was, you know, one unfinished thing after another, a life that really wasn't full of passion or filled with any goals or direction of any kind, I just did not know what I was going to do and how I was going to change my life. This was in the late 90s. And I have a younger brother, John, who's an amazing athlete, and he does many of these sports, mountain biking, climbing, and all that. And he had gone through a life sort of transition of his own and discovered these sports, and it changed him. And he became a very confident person, and he was living a life that I wanted to live, not per se for what he was doing, but for how he was feeling about himself. And he was constantly learning new things about himself and gaining a confidence, right? And a knowledge of oneself that I just wished I had. And so that's how I started doing these things. And one thing leads to another, as they say, and you know, you find the things that you love. And they don't necessarily, you don't set out necessarily on a path that you're going to make it your job. And that certainly wasn't my goal. Initially, my goal was just to become truly a happy person instead of being an unhappy person pretending to be a happy person on the outside. I wanted to really experience what it was like to be truly happy in my life and have my own goals and my own things that I wanted to achieve. And lo and behold, adventure would teach me those things, and running specifically would teach me those things. And I often have said running has become my greatest teacher. I think I've gone completely off on a tangent here, but
beautiful.
It's related to what we're talking about.
For sure. I wonder, like, too, and I ask all my guests to go back to like their childhood and stuff. And like, was there any inklings that you might be this way, or did you have that knack for adventure?
Well, we had amazing parents growing up, my brother and I mean, we really did. Like, we lived on a small sort of hobby farm in the Ottawa Valley, and we were outside all the time because that's just what you did. This is like I'm talking, dude, like if you wanted to go play with some of your schoolmates, they lived across a 30-acre hayfield, and you either had to cross that hayfield or your parents would have to call their parents and catch them on the phone because nobody even had answering machines. I mean, you know, it's like, it was ridiculously old school. And so you had to entertain yourselves. We had three television channels. I mean, that's it. So you were outside all the time. So I think, you know, in retrospect, maybe a love for the outdoors came from that early life that we were so fortunate to have growing up in the countryside, right? Summers spent, you know, riding horses or baling hay and just doing work outside, gardening stuff, whatever, you know, and then forgetting about all of that, you know, for a huge part of my life, and then reconnecting with the outdoors with what I do now professionally, you know?
For sure. And were your parents like encouraging of that type of, you know, lifestyle activity that you would, you know, adventures that you would go on a daily basis?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, well, I mean, look, I mean, it was again, different time, right? Like I have kids, I don't kick them outside and say, all right. And they say, okay, well, I'm going to go 2 kilometers away to my friend's house. I'll catch you later. You know, it was a time when, you know, they kicked you outside and you didn't come back until, you know, it was dinner time. Mm. Right. Mm-hmm. And it was just a different time. So I, you know, I don't know the answer to that question necessarily, but I think it could have been. But look, I was not a sporty person because in high school, grade school, high school, et cetera, I hated phys ed. Like I hated gym class. I cannot throw a ball. I can't skate. I can't hit a puck. I can't do any of those things that were sort of the conventional sport of the day, right? So I never even bothered to try. You know, I briefly in school ran, but it was not something that was, you know, it was a gym class thing you had to do. You know what I'm saying? It was phys ed, so, which I hated. So therefore, everything that was in that class, I, you know, was not taking any pleasure in doing. So it wasn't like I grew up a sporty person at all.
Yeah. And actually like reading, Running for Your Life, Running for My Life, in the very beginning of that book, you know, you talk a lot about that and like growing up and your childhood and stuff. And a lot of it was like understanding or trying to figure out if you were good at anything, you know. And I think you touch on it quite a bit. And it struck me and was like, wow, it's hard for kids to grow up, you know, and if they're not good at sports or they're not good at certain things, like how that can change them or lead them down a path, maybe not forever, but temporarily, you know. Was that something that weighed on you like for a good chunk of your life until you decided to make a change?
Well, you know what? I think, not necessarily. I mean, for starters, that that book's a long time ago.
Right.
You know, that book ended before Running the Sahara, right? So things have changed in my mind as well since then. But you know, I think that it's very difficult. When I look back, a common question I get is, you know, do you have any regrets or do you have anything that you wish you had done or do you have any, you know, and the truth is I don't. I have absolutely no regrets for the way that my life lived because I wouldn't feel the way I do now. I wouldn't be so stoked about the things that I do now if I wasn't living the prior life that I had. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's like by going back and wishing a different beginning, you know, then the great things in your life now that you have wouldn't necessarily have happened.
Right.
So it's a perspective that is very hard for me to analyze, I guess, you know?
Yeah, totally. And then, you know, you have to like go through those things too to bring you to a point where like you wanted to make a change. You didn't want to smoke anymore and live the, you know, the party kind of lifestyle. So it brings you to a breaking point, I guess. Like, is it a pretty clear line in your mind? Cause you say it like the second part of your life, but was that pretty like clear? Is it clear for you where that happened and what was the breaking point for you?
Well, I think it was, again, whenever you think of anything, you go back in your life 20 or 30 years, you are remembering a patchwork of events. All I can remember is just coming to a point where I was like, okay, well, you know what? I'm not going to be able, this is not a sustainable life, the way I was polluting my body and doing everything else I was doing. This is not a sustainable life. And path forward. It's just not. So what are my options? So that would have been like the late 90s. But to say there was like this single spectacular aha moment, this is when it's going to happen. Well, I mean, real life for me, at least, it didn't kind of work that way. It was a 3-year process for me to quit smoking because I love smoking so much and I loved partying. So it was really hard for me to do that. So when I started doing these outdoor activities with my brother, I was still like 2-3 years of, you know, riding mountain bikes and drinking my face off. You know, it wasn't until I made the, you know, I sort of drew the line in the sand, if you will, New Year's Eve, 1999, January 1st, 2000, that was going to be the day that I would never look back, you know, and I was going to give it everything I had and see where things would take me. And in a very short period of time from January 2000 to like the, you know, 2002 kind of thing, within those 2 years, like my body completely transformed. Like I realized I had the same genetic engine for endurance that my brother had. Mm-hmm. It's just that I never knew I had it, right? Because I've been polluting myself since I was, you know, 15 years old. So, you know, to me, it was almost like a rebirth. So not only did I change something mentally and emotionally in my mind, the way I was doing things, but also I physically was changing radically. And that feeling of an awakening was amazing. And that's when I, you know, and then I started running, as you know from reading that book. The first running race I did was the Yukon Arctic Ultra. And I didn't just complete that race, I actually won it. And I had never won anything like endurance-based like that in my entire life. Like, I couldn't believe it that I actually... You know, here I was 35 and it felt like I was, you know, it was like I was meeting someone for the first time that was me, you know. And I remembered in that race, at the end of that race, thinking that people, you know, many of us underestimate ourselves physically, mentally, and emotionally. And that 100-mile race in the Yukon in the middle of winter really magnified that to me. It made it very and abundantly clear that it was not something that necessarily applied to me, but applied to people in general, that all of us is capable of doing something extraordinary in our lives if we really want to. And it would lead me down a path of doing ultramarathons and competing in ultramarathons around the world one after another in a very short period of time, because I just loved the things I was learning about myself, like crazy shit. Like I was learning that, you know, I could go further than I ever thought on my feet. I could endure through extreme heat or extreme cold. You know, I could find my way across a jungle. I was doing these races that were very adventure-y, you know, style of ultra marathons. And I was loving it. It just felt great. And then of course the idea came up to run across the entire Sahara Desert, and that changed everything
right.
for me.
Yeah.
Professionally.
Because you know, typically people like, I'll start with a 5K, I'll start with a 10, go up to the marathon, then maybe ultra. Is like, what was the allure for you like to go for like these extreme adventure race type of things, you know? Like the progression for most runners isn't as quick as the one you experienced. Like, do you know why that is, or?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I have to, you know, it's funny. It's one of those questions that I kind of have to think about. You know, for me, in doing that first race, the impetus, if you will, or the inspiration for that first race didn't come from like a place where it's like, all right, well, you know, why start with a marathon? I'm just going to go run 160K. It was nothing like that. I actually read an article in a magazine that was about that race in particular, ultramarathons, but that race in particular. And I was mesmerized by the people in this magazine article and in further, you know, further research on the race website, these people who were so seemingly normal looking, like I felt like I could totally relate to them, but they were extraordinary because they were doing something that was so out there. Like to me anyhow, I was like, what the hell, right? Like I'd done tons of adventure racing by that point. I raced my mountain bike all over, mm-hmm. you know, but, you know, this was just a completely different thing. I mean, to be on your feet that long. And, but yet, lo and behold, these people appear so normal. Like, what gives? Like, what is it that they knew about or learned about themselves in doing something like this that was so powerful that some of these people, it wasn't even their first time doing it. It was like their second time doing the race. That they would go back and do this thing again, which lends the question, what did they learn in the first time that made them come back that second time or go and do these things in different parts of the world? And whatever it was that they knew about themselves or learned about themselves was something that I was still potentially looking for in my life or thought I knew but didn't know yet, but they inspired me to want to go and do it. It had nothing to do with the length, and nothing to, it was just these people.
Mm-hmm.
I saw them and I'm like, wow, that is like so crazy. I got to go do that. And that's how it started. And I entered that race.
So then when you did your first, did you feel like you had tapped in or understood them better? Completely.
Because it was in that first race that, you know, the longest training run I did leading up to that race, I remember a buddy of mine and I, we took the sled that I got at Walmart to put my gear in for that race. I had no money at the time, like nothing. And we loaded up gear and I pulled this sled for 60K around Chelsea through the Gatineau Park. And I mean, I started out running, like the first 30K was running. And then by the end of it, dude, I was like, I remember us trying to get back. I had an apartment then in Chelsea. I remember us trying to get back to the apartment so desperately exhausted and sore. And I remember walking into my apartment and laying, I had a futon there, and laying on this futon and thinking, oh my God, there's no way I'm going to be able to do that race. Like, there's just no way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But then, and then I go and I do that race, and like the first 80K kind of just slipped by. That's when the wheels came off at 80K. And then I had to convince myself to keep going, which I did. And it's a much longer conversation for mm-hmm. another time, but I convinced myself to keep going and was able to go the entire 160K. So to be able to finish that race and not only just finish it, but feel better at the end than I did at the beginning because I was so high on adrenaline and confidence after doing this thing that I just thought, oh my God, like it's like this is a magical thing that people have inside themselves. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that those people learned about themselves and challenging themselves, that when you really are pressed, you can rise to the occasion. You look during COVID, you know, you see things happening during this pandemic that are just mind altering. A vaccine, dude, in less than a year.
Right.
A vaccine in less than a year. Think about that. How long have they been working on other vaccines? It takes them years, 10 years sometimes, 15 years to develop a vaccine. But people said, we got to do this. We got to do this now, right? And they rose to the occasion. So I think that when people are under tremendous pressure, sometimes in whatever way that you define that pressure, because we all create that, we can create our own environment around us, then you either thrive in it or it gets the better of you, you know?
Right. Now, did you seek guidance for that type of race?
Oh, yeah. I had tons of friends helping me. Tons of friends trying to help me. I had one buddy who took me. So I was in really, really great shape before the race started from all the mountain bike racing and adventure racing I was doing. But running, I probably ran like a handful of times with my brother, stuff like that. Like running wasn't a thing for me, right? So as you know from reading that first book, that I had not ran in any organized running events at all before doing the Yukon Arctic Ultra. So I wasn't really 100% sure how to apply the fitness that I had from all the things I was doing to running. So I had a friend, he's no longer alive, but I had a friend at the time, one of my best friends, and he was an amazing runner, this guy. Like he ran ultra marathons all over the world. And he said, well, look, I'm going to teach you how to run. And I said, okay. And so we would go out and we would do these run walks. Because that's, I would have to actually, like running was just harder on my legs. But again, I have to say, I was in extremely good shape. Like I would ride my mountain bike 6 hours at a time.
Mm.
Like race pace. Like I was super fit on the mountain bike, but just running was a different thing. It was just achy and all that stuff. And so at any rate, he showed me how to do that. You know, I would get onto these, like I would run 5K, for example, and then I would walk for a K, right? Then I'd crank it back up again. So he was teaching me, and I remember the one time we went and did this run, and we ran, and he was helping me with my running technique, and again, longer physiological story, but my hip flexors were really tight, and so, you know, I lengthened out my hip flexors, and I was in a more upright posture. I read a book by a friend of mine named Danny Dreyer. He wrote a book called Qi Running. Read that book, started doing a lot of the stuff that was in that book, and applying it, looking at the way my feet were striking the ground. Like, in the same way that I, in my previous life, put so much energy and time into drinking as much as I possibly could, I put that same energy into running technique, running properly. Mm. You know what I mean?
Right.
The defeatism, self-defeatism that I had in the first 30 years of my life, give or take, where I would talk myself out of trying new things, talk myself out of taking chances, out of taking risks. Now I was talking myself into and was willing to try. Okay, well, try this, try that. You know what I mean? Like, I was really after it. So anyhow, we go for this run, and we do the 7-kilometer loop that was near the apartment that I was living in those days. And I remember I ran door to door and didn't have to take a walking break. And I remember how amazing that felt. There was something about that run that really stuck in my head. I would go on to do epic runs with that guy. I mean, once I did the Yukon, all bets were off. Eh? Like, I was running 40K at a time on the weekend. Like, I was just running like crazy after that. But in that first 7K, which was before, incidentally, the 60K crawl that I did right before the race. This was early days, that 7K run. That feeling I had, a sense of accomplishment. I've often been asked, what did it feel like when I, after 111 days, running an average of 70 kilometers a day, reached the edge of the Red Sea after running across the Sahara Desert? What did it feel like? And I often describe that day that I ran the 7K. Like, the great things that we achieve and do in our lives are very relative to us as individuals as well. And we can't really explain how good something can feel to someone else. But we know it internally, what it feels like, right? And so it's appreciating, it's less important what others think. At the end of the day, who gives a shit what anyone else thinks? That's zero impact on how you feel about yourself and what you're doing. So when I've been asked that question, I've often said, you know what? It felt the same way as that day when I ran that door-to-door 7K loop with my buddy, and how I was like, wow, I didn't have to take any walking breaks at all. Like, it just went so smoothly.
Right.
And so running the Sahara, you know, reaching the edge of that Red Sea, it was that same sense of satisfaction.
Amazing.
You know?
Yeah. Were you working at this time? Like
yeah, I was personal trainer. Things?
Okay.
Personal trainer. Okay. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how do you go
Sorry, I was going to say, you know, in the same way that I followed my brother into his passions, I followed his career path as well, because I was so inspired by his, you know, his ability to, and he's a very specialized trainer. Him and his wife own a business called Continuum Fitness, and they work with people with, you know, injuries or, you know, very, very functional fitness. They're some of the best functional coaches in North America, for sure. And so at the time, though, he was doing more basic concepts in functional fitness, and I was learning from him, and I just loved the way he could help people. So I decided that I would start doing what he did. And that's became my job as well. I
love that. So then how do you go from that and then begin to start thinking about a expedition like the one you did across the Sahara? Because that was absolutely insane. I watched the documentary. For anybody who hasn't seen it, they definitely should. Like, the waves of emotion, you could feel it in you guys. You could feel it, like, as the days went on and the people you met and then the discoveries you made. Like, how did you get there? Like, how did you get to something like that?
Well, I had this idea to run across the Sahara. And I met some buddies ultra running in races, Kevin and Charlie, and the three of us decided that, hey, you know, we're going to do this thing. And, you know, we were so committed to it. It took us a year to make it happen. Maybe longer, because we first started talking about it in I guess it would have been late 2004, if memory serves me correct. And then we left November 2006. But, you know, it was such an audacious at the time idea that, you know, nobody really believed that we were going to do it, right? And I think it was one of those things. I remember being in Senegal as we were starting and thinking to myself, there's no way I'm going to make it. Like, I really thought, these guys are like actual ultra runners. I have been ultra running the last 2 years. There's no way, like, scientific odds, bet making, I am the one of the three that is not going to make it across this. Like, I just simply don't have the mileage that these guys have. And so, and I remember where I was standing, what I was looking at. I was looking at a bunch of camera gear that these film people had, and like all of this camera crew. You know, we were at this camp before the expedition started, and I'm looking at them load their bags up, and I'm thinking, oh my God, there are all these people that are putting so much work into this documentary, and I'm not even going to make it. You know, like that's what I was thinking. But you know, one step at a time. Mm-hmm. One step at a time. And there was a lot of really bad days out there. Mm-hmm. But we eventually got to the Red Sea and, you know, injuries, everything. It was friggin' hard. It was really hard to do. But we were able to do it. And in completing that expedition, it opened my mind to the possibilities. You know, it opened my mind to the fact that I could be on an expedition like that for 111 days. Someone who barely got out of high school and could learn so much about agriculture, culture, economics, environment. All of these lessons were coming from an adventure through North Africa. Mm. And I thought, wow, how potent adventure is, you know, when we can learn from it and storytell from it. So I decided at the end of running the Sahara that I would invest everything I learned from that into starting this foundation called Impossible to Possible, where I take young people on expeditions around the world and of their own, and the expeditions are 100% free of charge. So, you know, and of course I've gone on to do multiple expeditions of my own since the Running the Sahara expedition. Like, it's funny, you know, you mentioned the first book, and I said that book ends at Running the Sahara. Well, since Running the Sahara, like, I've done, if you include youth expeditions, something like 31 expeditions, mm-hmm. You know? It's been a huge, busy period these last 13 years, going on 14. And, the other crazy question I'll get from people is, like, well, are you slowing down? And it's like, no, you know, it's funny, because I'm looking into my backyard right now, and I'm looking at the trees that look the same as they did 13 years ago. Well, not quite, because I wasn't in this house 13 years ago, but 2009 we moved to this house. So that long ago, and not much has changed, right? I just continue to do these projects, and I'm very passionate about doing these things that I love. So when you love something and you're passionate about something, it's not really, you work hard, but it's different how you internalize that work. It doesn't feel like a labor. It feels like a satisfaction,
right.
You know?
Right, a labor of love, we'll call it.
Yeah. I was going to say that, but then I thought you'd think it was cheesy.
No. I was going to comment, though, like, you know, when you were looking at your teammates, and I think we do this a lot in our lives, that it doesn't matter what level we're at, but, like, will we compare ourselves to other people, and we let that determine what we can do? Like, I find it fascinating that... you know, even somebody at your level, maybe not at the time, you didn't believe it, but then you did it, you know? And I think that's really powerful.
Well, I think the, you know, life is very much about learning constantly. And if we don't remain humble and sustain a certain amount of humility in our lives, at the same time being able to take risks and take chances, then we're never going to really progress in learning about ourselves. Once you think you have everything all figured out, you're screwed because you don't have it all figured out, right? And that's part of the momentum, I believe, of life, is that snowball effect to learning about yourself as you're down the path. Life would be pretty boring if you had everything absolutely 100% figured out. Right? So there's a challenge in learning about oneself, but also appreciating the things that you've been able to do, but not dwelling on those things that you've been able to do. So, you know, for example, when we started running the Sahara, well, by that point, I'd won a handful of ultramarathons. I got on to win other races, not just the one in the Yukon. So you would think that would breed a certain amount of confidence that, well, hey, I've been able to do these things. Yeah, it gave me the confidence to get to the start, to get to Senegal. But after that, it was a complete no man's land for me. Or no person's land, if you think about it, because I had never ran that far, been that far on my feet in my entire life as to run across the Sahara Desert. So who was I to think that I was going to 100% make it for sure? Now, there's been an evolution in that thought. Now, when I go on expeditions, I'm like, okay, this part of it, the physical part of it, I got this done. I got this down. I can physically do this. There is no doubt now. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Running the Sahara was a layer of the onion that was removed. It was something that I learned. I proved to myself that I could do it. Now I know I can do this until I don't want to do it anymore. Now, what else is there to learn, right? And so you're always finding new things. Sometimes it's nuanced. Sometimes it's in bold letters, but you're always learning new things. You know, in life.
Would you say that
adventure magnifies those things?
For sure.
So
would you say that that's been your greatest accomplishment to date? Or, I mean, you've done so many things after that, but like.
No, I think my greatest accomplishment to date has been having kids.
Okay.
Because even when I was a train wreck in the old days, I always knew I wanted to be a dad. I just always wanted to be a dad. It's just something that I always wanted to be, was a dad. I had a great dad. I wanted to be a dad and do things with my kids, you know? And, we had our first daughter, then we had our second daughter. And I'll tell you, you know, getting out, you know, one's going to be 13, the other one just turned 10. They can trail run. They'll go as far as you want to go. The fast packing, flat water paddling, you know, they skiing, amazing cross-country skiers. And when I say go for a trail run, I mean, we routinely ran 20-kilometer trail runs this summer. And running, like, I mean, not they're not walking anywhere. They're running, right? And it's not with force or pressure. And just the fact, yeah, obviously some days they don't feel like it, we don't go. It's as simple as that, right? And it's not like we're running 20 kilometers every day. But the fact that they're passionate about the outdoors, they have their own goals in doing things in the outdoors, is way more, like being with them, being our family, the four of us, being out on the trails, fast packing some mountains in Quebec, you know, those moments are the most meaningful moments that I've had so far.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like it's the four of us. It's our family. We're doing things and we're doing it for us because we want to do these things together.
Right.
Like that's greater for me than running across the Sahara Desert.
For sure. And like, how do you, what do they think of dad? Like they think you're nuts with the stuff you're doing or like, well, it's normal to them?
Well, it's very normal to them because they've been born into it. Like,
yeah.
They were crawling through my gear when I was packing for expeditions, yeah. You know, that it's just totally normalized to them. And so, and we don't have like, you know, I have a filing cabinet, and I've mentioned this before in different interviews. It's like we have a filing cabinet in our house that has, I have a Guinness World Record. It's in there. I have awards, for a Meritorious Service Cross of Canada. I was awarded that 1 year for Impossible to Possible. That's in there. Nothing is on our walls. Like there's the magazine articles, all that stuff. It's all stored away. And I don't want constant reminders to my kids that their dad does all these things and, you know, and blah, 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 blah. I don't want that to be the message, as does my wife. My wife is an amazing, accomplished ultra runner, does these 200-mile races. All her medals, her buckles, all that stuff are all upstairs, you know, and we just don't display that stuff. And instead, we want to celebrate what our kids are achieving and doing, and we make a bigger deal out of that. So the atmosphere in our house is very much normalized and equalized.
Mm, I love that.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's great. And like, yeah, it's like a new, the story you guys are creating together, you know, it's not, it's moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'll tell you, yeah. I'm doing the expeditions. I'm doing the hard stuff. I'm going out there. We're creating films or capturing photographs, or we're doing the youth expeditions. We've done 14 youth expeditions around the world. We're doing all these amazing things. I don't need to also in my home with my kids talk about that all the time. You know?
Yeah, for sure. I had a question of course.
You know?
I had a question about like, I know you know, you'll say like, setting limits on ourselves as human beings, we can do anything we put our minds to, but how do you set limits on these extreme adventures? Like in terms of like safety and, I mean, from what I've seen and read, like that you, all the things you do, like it seems like pretty dangerous stuff and like could be almost life threatening, you know, if you're not careful or don't prepare properly. So how do you put the lines on an expedition?
Well, I mean, again, great question. I plan my expeditions more than I plan my trips to the grocery store, right? And everything, I don't take anything for granted, you know? And so it's super, years of planning goes into an expedition, I guess, is the bottom line. And so I won't do or take risks that I feel will put others at risk. You know what I mean? Like I try to weigh everything and say to myself, okay, what are the chances that I'm gonna have to call for rescue on this one, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And if it's like, well, there's a pretty good chance that the shit could hit the fan and then you're gonna have to call for a helicopter, I'm not gonna do it then. Do you know what I mean? But at the same time, there have been expeditions where there's been a lot of close calls. There's a tremendous amount of risk, but I mitigate it with extensive planning and preparation and not taking anything for granted. It's not like I come up with an idea and I'm like, okay, I'm going to run the length of the Atacama Desert solo. I'm going to be navigating 30 to 50K at a time, you know, before I get a resupply of water and it's 55 degrees Celsius out. Let's just go. You know what I mean? I took a year, at least 1 year of mapping that route extensively, you know, doing the best I could. Still, there's going to be surprises when you're out there, but I mean, I guess that part of it, that's one of the compelling parts of, that's why it's an adventure,
right? Yeah, totally. I love that, and I love the fact, I want to talk a bit more about Impossible to Possible, because I think it's really cool how you like include students in those type of expeditions. You interact with schools and classrooms and like challenge them to do things that are good for the environment and stuff like that. Can you touch on that? Like, it's really like evolved over the years and,
Well, Impossible to Possible, we have a mandate of providing free educational resources to schools around the world and free youth-based expeditions that are learning-based to our selected youth ambassadors who go on these expeditions from around the world. So basically, you know, to give you an example, and we've had expeditions, I mean, everywhere from the Amazon jungle to Rajasthan to Bolivia to the Arctic, et cetera, et cetera. But I'll give you an example of one. So we did a youth expedition to the Grand Staircase Escalante in Utah. And we partnered with some paleontologists from the University of Utah and the BLM. And out there, we, our youth ambassadors ran, I can't remember what, there's four or five of them on that team. And I think they probably ran, I don't know, 25 kilometers a day over the course of a week. And each day as they would run across this incredibly remote and amazing wilderness, they would stop at a specific site that it was relevant to telling the story and creating a curriculum of the rise of the dinosaurs in that region. So the expedition became a thread or a narrative by which a thread to teach the narrative, this educational module, resource modules about paleontology, basic paleontology. So one day they ran, I remember they scaled up the side of a mountain and it was to go to this plateau and see actual dinosaur footprints embedded in, you know, I guess it was probably mud a billion years ago, and now it's like, it's rock, right? And then the next day, running down to a dinosaur dig site where dinosaur bones were actually being casted. And so they you know, participated in that. This is streamed live. Either it's filmed and then edited and then uploaded to the live website, or it's streamed live. We do both things. Mm-hmm. And students in classrooms, tens of thousands of students in classrooms around the world can tap in for free. So the entire thing is free. It's free for the kids that go on the youth expeditions. It's free for the faculty that are donating their time to help create the educational programming. And then it's free for the schools to participate.
That's so cool. That's like, it's
like the true experiential learning. It's experiential learning, and we change the subject every time, right? We've done ecosystem services. We've done biodiversity. We've done access to healthcare. We cover all sorts of different topics.
Yeah, and I'm sure that kids, like, just light up. I mean, there's no better way to learn than to actually physically see it and touch it. And they must be in awe of the things that they're getting to experience through what you're able to bring them.
Well, everybody gets something different out of it, right? And I've had, youth that have followed the expeditions from a classroom jump on board later on and become youth ambassadors, right? I don't select the youth ambassadors or anything like that, but, you know, it's just amazing how it all comes together, you know?
For sure. What's the best advice you've ever been given?
Best advice I've ever been, well, I think, look, it's the basic, it's some of the most basic things that we've already talked about, mm-hmm. but really being more focused on what you think or what you need to do rather than doing things to consistently, you know, I don't want to say please others because it's great to please other people, right? But I mean, in the sense of, you know, making or taking those chances and those risks in life, being willing to live a little, I think is some of the best advice I've had. You know, when you spend a tremendous amount of time talking yourself out of doing things because you're afraid of what someone else is going to think if you fail, you're missing out on a lot of life, you know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's, I mean, a lot of times we talk things out and like want to do things, but never actually take the time to act on them too. You know, it's one thing to say it, but then it's another thing to do it. Like sometimes we spend years and years and years talking about doing something that we never get to do, you know? So.
No, exactly. And you know, you got to think about it. We live in a society and in a time now when everything is so fast paced and instantaneous, and maybe not so much during the pandemic, but typical times where everything's so fast paced and instantaneous and it looks virtual and it's everything else. Well, I mean, you know, time is something that you don't get back, you know? And so every day that slips by is one day less that you have on the planet.
For sure.
What
is, like, you prepare for all these expeditions, but what does training look like for you on a regular basis? Like, how do you possibly, like, this running across the Sahara took 111 days and you ran over a marathon every single day. Like, probably.
Yeah, there was no training for that. There was no training. It was like the training I was doing for the ultra marathons I was doing before I went. That was what I counted as the training to go to the Sahara. There just wasn't any training. I mean, obviously things have become much more succinct now for my expeditions. What I've done in the last probably 5 going on 10 years with my expeditions is I am very specifically training for the thing now that I'm doing. So for example, if I'm doing a winter Arctic expedition, it could be minus 60. So I'm preparing my body to be in those cold conditions, pulling a sled, which is tremendously difficult, with all my food and supplies for an unsupported expedition. So, you know, I'm dialing everything towards that, building strength and power. Or when we ran the length of the Namib Desert in summer 2018, I did that one. I knew it was going to be close to 2,000 kilometers of insanely rocky and brushy terrain because that's what that desert's like. So I trained all summer, Northern Hemisphere summer. I trained running the gnarliest trails I could so mm-hmm. that I would be ready to go there and, you know, cross the desert and not be so beat up by it. I still got beat up by it, but, you know, it's factoring all those things in. And something that's really interesting as well too, that I have written about this on social media, and it's something that I think is important, is that, you know, I just turned 52. And even when I reached 50, it wasn't lost on me that I'm actually, for a better part of the year, fitter and faster than I was on the same trails at 35.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what's super duper interesting. And I think it's because the older I get, the further down this road I get, the more serious I take my nutrition, my recovery, you know, everything, all the little things, I'm very careful with it, you know?
Right. Can you share some tips and tricks on nutrition and recovery with us?
Well, I mean, balance is everything, mm-hmm. for sure, in life. And I think that the biggest tip I can give someone is to really understand and listen to your body and know your body. One of the things that I've done, when I was training for an extended period of time, I was training a lot of runners around the world with specific goals. And I would say to them, listen, you got to write down what you're eating on a day-to-day basis. Keep a food journal for a month or two and write down the foods you're eating. And then the next day, write down how your workout felt or how you feel in the moment when you're eating that food, so that you become very aware. By writing it down, you become aware. Oh, potatoes make me feel like shit. You know, so you get to know that potatoes make you feel horrible, or maybe pasta makes you feel great, or maybe no pasta makes you feel great. So it's really understanding, listening to your body and dialing in nutrition, because you know the old saying, you are what you eat. Well, somebody came up with you are what you eat, because it's kind of true, right? How you fuel your body, yeah. How you fuel your body, the foods you put in your body, is you're going to see a result from that. And if you're picking foods that work better for you, you're going to feel that much better, right? Yeah. So so body intuition and nutrition intuition is super important. And then getting enough rest. The older we get, the more rest we need. So it's okay to take days off from training,
mm-hmm.
totally. You know, and getting sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you chasing now, Ray? And like, what do you want I'll use the word legacy. It's kind of, you know, it's a big word, but what do you want to be remembered by?
I want to be remembered as being a good dad. You know what I mean? At the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
what are you leaving behind? You know, what do you want to leave behind? Everybody's got a different version of what it is they want to leave behind. Some people it's $1 billion in a bank account. Other people it's a gymnasium named after them. Other people it's a photo book of amazing memories. It could be anything, you know, whatever it is that's relative to the individual is the most important thing. So for me, I just want my kids to say, yeah, you know what, he this, that, and the other, but still at the end of the day, pretty cool dude, you know, like then I'm all right with it.
Pretty
you know?
Cool dad that they can hang out with in the outdoors. Any exciting expeditions coming out? I sort of saw you post something about a couple of expeditions coming out. I don't know if you can talk about them, but
yeah, I'm not going to, cause I don't want to, I'm superstitious. I don't want to jinx myself, but I'm working on stuff right now. I'm working on stuff in this pandemic that we're in.
Yeah.
And respecting the boundaries of the pandemic and will not broach those. So only willing to move ahead with projects if things seem feasible, which I'm hoping they will, by midsummer, but we'll see. So, that's, you know, but stay tuned. I will post about stuff once I'm, feel like that we're in the clear.
And has the pandemic been a challenge for you?
Well, I mean, you know, basically my entire capacity to earn an income stopped, right? I'm self-employed more or less. So everything stopped. And, when that did happen, so I was on expedition in January last year up in the Arctic. I came back. Then I was guiding clients in Siberia with my guiding company. And I came back from that. And then a few weeks later, we were in lockdown. So from that point forward, I wasn't able to travel and speak. So I speak to a lot of companies all over the world. That stopped. Source of income gone. I'm not paid for my work with Impossible to Possible. I'm a volunteer, so no income there. And I wasn't able to guide, so no income there. And I'm also, I race direct in Gatineau Park. I direct a couple of races, no races. So basically, you know, everything just kind of stopped, right? And I thought about it, I thought, well, shit, I mean, I'm going to lose a lot of sleep over not having an income. But then I thought, you know, I can worry about this, chronically worry about this, and dig a really deep hole that's going to be hard to get out of, or I can just accept that it's the way things are right now, mm-hmm. and just try to move ahead from it and start finding, you know, different things in the interim to do. I mean, obviously there's great support networks out there and stuff like that. My wife is very busy with her work. So, you know, I invested instead my time and energy into developing our coffee with Capic One, which Capic One is the guiding company. And we had been talking for a few years about bringing our coffee to market, but we just really went all in last year during the pandemic and said, no, let's do it now. Let's get it out now. Ooh. And, you know, it's been a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun. And it's something that I'm very proud of and our team is very proud of because it represents us. It is who we are. We are like insane coffee aficionados. We are coffee aficionados to the max. Like we are, our hashtag is no coffee, no expedition. And that's because it's true. What? You know, we've never done an expedition without really good coffee. We will sacrifice weight. I will carry the extra weight, dude, of the beans in my backpack to have the good coffee.
Amazing.
It's what... Yeah, we never skimp on the coffee.
Well, yeah,
and you know, on the Arctic expeditions, if you're like 20 days in the Arctic, well, that's going to be like for us, for me and a teammate. Let's say that's 5 pounds of coffee.
Yeah, you that's know? Dedication and right there.
We take it, dude. We'll take that extra 5 pounds. We'll take a lighter sleeping bag and freeze every night in order to have good coffee. You know?
Yeah. What's your go-to for coffee?
Well, it's our own. So that okay. we have a dark roast blend, Capic One, Arctic Dark is my favorite one of all of our. We have four roasts, and that one is my favorite. But you know, yeah, check it out.
I'm gonna have to check all it your out.
To the million and a half listeners that you have. Check it out.
Maybe we can get them a promo code or something. We'll
yeah, send exactly. them over.
Yeah, no, I
know. With all those listeners, you're going to shut our website down. You know, I better be careful. We'll give you discount codes.
out of stock on everything. Exactly. Yeah, talking to my good friends, Kat and Kev, they said they had met you years ago, and that was one of your early requests, was a nice espresso. So I had a little
intel on the coffee. And I remember where we stopped for that espresso, believe it or not. I remember the exact spot where we did that. So
incredible. Yeah, it's a small world after all.
Yeah.
So what has all this taught you, Ray, if you can sum it up?
Well, I mean, look, there's just so many things that it's taught me. But I think the older I get, I think the more comfortable I've become with myself. Like we become very comfortable with ourselves. And I think an evolution of growth for all of us, especially in this world of adventure or sport, is the excitement in seeing the next generation coming up and being genuinely excited for people that are doing cool things. You know what I mean? Like, I love it now when I'm contacted by someone and they say, hey, you know, I've got this thing I want to do and can you help me out? Can you give me some advice? What kind of gear? And I just love that because that was me at one point. And that's the stage I'm at now, right? In life. And I, rather than fearing aging or anything else, I'm actually embracing it because I'm at a point where I'm in that magic spot where I'm still fit enough and fast enough to go do these really hard things and my body recovers and it allows me to train really hard. But at the same time, I'm able to help others out who are just starting out or want to go and do a cool project of their own. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we, you know, if the entire journey has taught me anything, is that we do reach a point in our lives where we are genuinely comfortable enough, truly, honestly, like look yourself in the mirror and say it to yourself, honestly, comfortable with ourselves and say, look, this is what I am. This is who I am. This is it. And that's it, you know, and you accept your awesome things that you can do with your failings, if you want to call them that, or your less than awesome things, however you want to put it. And you're the whole package. And when, you know, we become less concerned about getting that pat on the back on your Instagram page, you don't need it. It's not what defines you.
So how do you keep it relatable for somebody who's, you know, your expeditions are month long at times or longer than that. And so how do you make it relatable for somebody that's like wanting to do like a marathon or 5K or 10K?
Well, I think, you know, it's realizing that everything begins with the first step. I've had people reach out to me, you know, across social media, and they'll say, well, listen, I follow all your stuff and, you know, I'm inspired. I want to get outside, but you know, I don't even own a pair of running shoes. I'd love to run a 5K or a 10K or maybe someday a marathon, but I don't even know where to begin. I'm on the couch. I don't even know what to do. And I say to them, you know what, here's the advice. And I actually talked about this the other day, ironically, on another podcast. But I said to this person in particular, I said, you know what? You don't need running shoes yet. Get up off the couch, walk to your front door, put whatever shoes on you have or winter boots, put them on, and then untie them, take them off and walk back to the couch. That's the end of day one. Day two, go back, same process, get to the front door, then walk outside, go to the end of your laneway, come back, or the end of your block, whatever, right? Come back and then sit on the couch. Build a process, and one day leads to another, that you don't have to actually build Rome in a day. And over time, things become much more attainable in one's mind, right? You start to see progress. Once you see a pattern of progress and movement forward, you build a confidence that, hey, maybe this can lead to B, which can lead to C and D and so on and so forth.
Mm, love that. Yeah, it's those baby steps. It's following the process and believing that you can do that that day after day. That's nice. I like that. What does running mean to you, Ray?
What does running mean to me? It means that I'm, you know, creating movement. I think running is one of the, it's such a, and there's so much has been written about this, but it's such a natural thing to do. It's something that for me is like a meditation almost. I love trail running. I love being out there in the woods alone, and just thinking. You know, and I also think that running is a healing thing to do as well. It's like, it gets this bad rap. Running gets a bad rap. You're going to get injured, so you better do X, Y, and Z. Well, you know what? If you develop your running program and your strength program and your flexibility program, and you develop it, you know, with not the same way that I ran across the Yukon, but if you develop your program in a suitable way, running is great for you. You know, it improves your cardiovascular health, bone density, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's a mind shift, running. Running is a great teacher of things.
Yeah, you can, yeah, and there's a lot to learn from it. And you can always learn something new on every run you go on. So watching you now, I believe that I'm actually working up in Nunavut, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, but I don't really run outside in the winter because of the conditions, but watching you now, I'm like, oh, maybe I should. So
if you're going up into Iqaluit, is that where you're going?
I'm in Rankin, like right off of Rankin.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, it's amazing. Amazing place.
Gotta gold mine up there.
Yeah. Just get out for a run. Just don't go where the polar bears are.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm limited, but maybe for now I'll keep it on the treadmills and we'll venture off in summer. But where can people find out more about you, about all the things you do and to get
I have a website. It's just my name, raysahab.com. And then of course I'm on all the popular social media platforms as well. Facebook, I have a public page. That's the one I communicate with people on. It's got a little blue check beside my name, so people will know when they get to it. And I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, blah, blah, blah. Right? So I'm easy
everywhere.
To find. I'm easy to find. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Well, we'll definitely put your links in the show notes so people can reach out if they have questions and find out more about you. But Ray, thanks so much. You know, I'd love to maybe meet with you or run with you one day. Seem like
that'd be awesome.
Awesome guy, and we don't live too far from each other. But thanks for taking the time today. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you. I'd love that. And thanks so much for your time today. And we'll see you out here at some point on the trails.
For sure. Take care.
Bye-bye.
This episode is brought to you by the WRG Run Club. What's really good is running with people who are fun, friendly, and positive. But seeing as we can't do that in person right now, let's try our best to stay connected through social media. How can you do that? Every Monday, we'll connect through a virtual run.
You can go out there at any time of the day and run any distance you choose. When you get home, share your run with us on Instagram by tagging at WRGRuns, and we'll post it in our stories for everyone to see. It's a tough time for everyone, so hopefully this helps us stay motivated to get out there and keep moving. If you want to learn more, visit our website, imarunner.ca, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Hope to see you all soon. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Rundown. We hope you enjoyed our show. Please make sure to visit us at imarunner.ca. You can also let us know what you think and follow us on Instagram at The Rundown. Now take what you've learned and run with it.
The Rundown is a production by WRG Media, recorded in the historic RCA building in St. Henry, Montreal. Produced and recorded by Forrest McKay. Our executive producers, Leslie and Lindsay Woods. Graphics and illustrations created by Ryan Bondi and hosted by Justin Pugliese.